Welcome to WISO Weekend, WYSO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenney. On today's program, Dakota Wright hit the Excursions stage this week to talk about his music with Nikki Dakota. We'll hear some of that interview. Also coming up, aviation commentator Dan Patterson will talk about the war to end all wars. It's almost 100 years after that war and many others. And later in the program, Bill Felker with Poor Will's Miami Valley Almanac. Up first, through December 1st, visitors to the National Museum of the United States Air Force in Dayton are getting a look at the inside of the plane that carried John F. Kennedy's body from Dallas to Washington, D.C. after his assassination. Friday was the 50th anniversary of that horrific event. It was in this Boeing 707 in 1963 that Lyndon Johnson took the oath of office, while Jackie Kennedy stood by his side, still wearing the pink suit stained in her husband's blood. The nation remained in shock after the grim events of that day, but museum historian Dr. Jeff Underwood says what happened on Air Force One was also a very private moment.
Dislocation and high politics and power politics, all the world is going on around, but right here, it all becomes very personal again with one woman sitting next to the body of her murdered husband.
Now the aisles of the plane are lined in plexiglass to preserve its interior, and for the most part it's been restored to its original condition. But there are still traces of the modifications the flight crew made on that day to accommodate the unusual circumstances.
They refused to put his casket in the cargo hold, so what they did was they pulled the last four seats out of the aircraft, and since they knew they wouldn't be able to get the casket into the back of the aircraft, they took a saw and cut off part of the bulkhead. And they removed it and put the casket right here so it ran the length of the aircraft.
The plane served as Air Force One for the next seven presidents, from Johnson to Clinton. In 1998, it was flown to Wright-Patt, where it is on display today. The exhibit has generated so much interest, the museum has extended the number of days that visitors can walk inside to see the historic artifact. This past week, WYSO aired a series of reports on manufacturing called Future Production. First, reporter Lewis Wallace told us how manufacturing in the Miami Valley is growing, slowly but surely adding jobs each year since 2010. But after decades of watching manufacturing jobs leave the area, turning business around and getting a younger workforce interested is a tall order. So Dayton area manufacturers are working on an image makeover.
In the wood-paneled main office of Staub Manufacturing, Steve Staub shows off his collection, an array of old metal novelties. He has shelves and shelves.
Fire hydrant, gas pump nozzle, ticket marking system for retail stores, and a little airplane badge that said Dayton, Ohio on it.
His office is a monument to the industry of the past. GM, Frigidaire, NCR, Staub holds up a toy cash register.
It's got gears and numbers and all kinds of stuff. No one's going to make anything like this in the United States these days. That'll be made in China because it's a throwaway toy.
And there's the clincher. That past is gone. From 2000 to 2009, businesses consolidated, closed, or went overseas, and manufacturing jobs in the greater Dayton area were cut in half.
And everything really just kind of died for us.
40,000 jobs drained out of the region, and just a few thousand have been added since 2010. Not exactly a roaring comeback. But now the remaining workforce is aging, and area manufacturers are actually having a hard time finding young, educated workers, the kind they need for increasingly high-tech work. The Staub Manufacturing Shop is not the assembly line a lot of people imagine. It's well-lit and clean, and workers use computers to operate in closed machines. They're building made-to-order parts for automakers, retailers, hospitals, you name it. Angela Urbaugh with the Dayton Area Manufacturers Association says Staub's shop is pretty standard.
You can walk into companies now and eat off the floor. It's just so shiny.
Even if you don't want to have your next meal on a shop floor, Urbaugh thinks manufacturing just has an image problem. She says these are well-paying, safe jobs in these shops.
So if we can just get people inside these facilities, see what's really like, then they're like, oh, okay, I didn't know, this is cool.
But a stroll through the North Dayton neighborhood near Staub Manufacturing tells a different story. The high-tech future hasn't really made it here. Gary Sams is tinkering with his tow truck in his driveway.
Everybody says the economy's coming back. I don't see it. I got a workout job over there, and then I run this truck at nighttime, so you know.
His other job is at a nearby steel plant, the kind of manufacturing that's been dying out here. He's recently had his hours cut. When I say the industry's having a hard time filling jobs, he just laughs.
I mean, they're just blowing, you know, smoke up your ass or what? You know what I mean? Because you know and I know, if GM shut down, there's 5,000 people right there.
Meanwhile, Gary Sam's adult son is out of work, and his daughter just got a job in a bowling alley. They never even considered manufacturing. Kids these days, he says, shaking his head.
They're in trouble.
And Sam's is living week to week himself, far from the industry's new high-tech frontier. From where he stands, working on his truck a mile or so from Steve Staub's place, Dayton is still struggling through a monumental slowdown.
In part two of Future Production, Lewis Wallace reported how manufacturers are using robots to recruit, but also how that strategy may fall short.
That's the sound of a death match going down. A gym at Wright State University is set up like an arena with a plexiglass cage in the middle. Inside, a boxy little robot called Mo is dominating, slamming another robot against the walls of the cage and then running it over. This match is over.
And the winner is Mo!
We just won our first match, so that was really exciting for us.
That's Joel Hemmelgarn from Coldwater, Ohio. And this is Extreme Bots, a competition that pairs area manufacturers with high school teams to make robots that do battle. This team's robot, Mo, didn't just win. It decimated its opponent. A little weaponry goes a long way, says teammate Shannon Osterfeld.
Our weapon that we just added, it's a chainsaw kind of thing, and it just spins.
But this competition isn't just for kicks. The manufacturers are doing outreach. As an aging workforce moves towards retirement, they need young workers willing to learn technical skills, like Troy Gabbard from New Lebanon. He's busy drilling and soldering some robot guts.
I'd like to go into professional remote controls, or go into a factory setting and work on the robotic arms.
But apparently guys like Troy are hard to get. A study out last year found almost three-quarters of area manufacturers who were hiring couldn't find qualified applicants. They want skilled machinists and welders, but many also say they need recruits with soft skills, like teamwork and critical thinking. And a lot of employers say they're just not seeing the kind of applicants they want. Angela Urbaugh is with the Dayton Region Manufacturers Association.
Many employers say, just give me somebody who will show up every day, drug-free, or is willing to work and is willing to learn.
An Extreme Bots instructor from Miami Valley Career Technology Center, Van Henderson, throws the workforce problem back at the industry. Outreach is fine, he says, but youth need apprenticeships and on-site training, too.
We need to get some consistency in the chain and get the employers to take these kids and say, okay, this is the next level.
And while manufacturing is growing bit by bit, that growth is outpaced by the healthcare and service industries. So Henderson says companies need to pay better. Starting wages in most shops are just around $10 an hour.
Money talks. I mean, everybody wants to do something they love, and that's nice. I mean, it'd be great if we could, but money talks also.
And frankly, some of the young people at Extreme Bots just aren't thinking about careers. Take the team from Coldwater. I ask them,
do any of you think that manufacturing is what you'll end up doing?
No, not really.
It's nice work, and you can get it. At least that's what the industry says. But getting workers beyond the robots and into the real world, that battle is still underway. For WYSO, I'm Lewis Wallace.
You're listening to WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us. 2014 marks the 100th anniversary of the beginning of World War I. Millions of soldiers and untold numbers of civilians died on European battlefields during the conflict, which was called the War to End All Wars, which, of course, it was not. We tend to remember the trench warfare of World War I, but it was the first conflict in the history of the world that included an air war as well. Dan Patterson has some thoughts.
When World War I started, aviation was new. Flight was more art than science back then. Advances came as a result of trial and error, cause and effect. Aerial observers had been used in warfare since the Civil War. A hot air balloon tethered to the ground would be sent up, and observers would get high enough to see over the horizon. Powered flight meant they could see beyond the horizon and go behind the battle lines. That's where air battles began. In 1914, aircraft were slow and fragile. Both the Allies and the Germans flew their observation planes behind enemy lines and soon found themselves in the same airspace. The first aerial combat took place when opposing pilots shot it out with pistols at surprisingly close range. Soon, faster, more maneuverable pursuit planes were developed to attack the observers, which began falling from the sky at an alarming rate. The life expectancy of an observation air crew grew short, so pursuit planes became escorts. Aerial tactics were being invented. Before long, machine guns were mounted on the fuselage. But at first, they couldn't fire through the aircraft's propellers, so engine propellers were moved to the rear. These cumbersome aircraft carried names like Gunbus. It was the German Air Force that created the first so-called fighter plane. It was small and nimble, designed by Antony Fokker. It had a gun that fired forward through the propeller, using a gear that timed the firing of the gun so it missed the propeller. The pilot could aim the aircraft and fire the gun at the same time. There's a painting by Henri Furet made early in the war. It depicts a British observation plane being attacked by a Fokker from behind. Out on the wing of the British plane, lying on his belly, is a rifleman aiming at the approaching fighter with his bolt-action rifle. Desperate times called for desperate solutions. Pursuit pilots developed tactics like get as close to your enemy as possible before firing, or create formations that can overwhelm the foe, and attack with the sun behind you. Observation aircraft evolve into large bombers with the ability to attack the enemy far beyond the front. They, too, learn to fly in formation, and soon legions of multi-engine bombers drone through the skies and explosives rain from the clouds. Before the war was over, the ability to attack cities from above became a harsh reality. Aviation advanced dramatically between 1914 and 1918 when the war ended. The art had become a science. Only 15 years after the Wright brothers flew at Kitty Hawk, men and women were climbing into cockpits all over the world. They would soon fly across continents and oceans, engage in international speed races, carry mail and cargo and passengers, and capture the imagination of human beings everywhere. For WYSO, this is Dan Patterson wishing you blue skies and tailwinds.
You can see photographs of some of the aforementioned aircraft from World War I and the painting by Henri Furet at WYSO.org. Aviation programming on WYSO is supported in part by the National Aviation Heritage Alliance and the Air Force Museum Foundation.
Do-do-do-do-do. The broken clock reads 404, 404. I'm somehow changed. Grinning politicians and deals being made.
We've got more music for you this week on WYSO Weekend. Dakota Wright has only been performing music for audiences in the last year. He's young, just 16 years old, but there is an ageless quality to his music. That's what WYSO's Nikki Dakota and Excursions listeners found out Friday when the musician stopped by the studios to play live. Here's part of that interview.
On the slopes of Hospital Hill, there's an old man who gets shivers, and he gets chills, and he wonders why it never trickles down to him.
I'm so pleased to welcome this fabulously talented, very, very dear young man into the studio, Dakota Wright. Welcome, and thanks for being here today.
Thanks so much.
Well, it's just a delight to have you. I have really enjoyed listening to the sound check. And before you start, and I do want you to play one, could you just explain briefly, we're about to hear a lot of sound, but you're making it all, and you have kind of an array of pedals in front of you.
Yeah, so I've got just my acoustic guitar and electric violin, and I have this loop pedal that I run everything through. It can hold, I haven't found a limit for the amount of time or the amount of loops that it can hold,
wow.
Which is good.
Wow, that's great. Haven't found the limit. Very good, yeah. And you put one in and then establish a pattern, then you lay over it and over
it,
and then you sing. It's just a delight. And if you would, tell us the name of a tune and go ahead, Dakota Wright on WISO.
And it doesn't have eyes the way we know eyes. It has a clear head. And it uses mirrors to achieve a remarkable field of vision that helps it to go about its day-to-day business. And there's some metaphors in this song somewhere, so here we go. Spookfish.
Built to worship prosperity. There were statues of gods carved in the stone, and a broken down couch to serve as a throne. Shrine, there swam a school of fish without eyes. They made not a sound from their gill to their tail, but listened instead to the lonely song of. They made not a sound, but the lonely song of the whale. song of the whale.
Dakota Wright on Excursions Live on 91.3 WYSO. All that sound from one person. What a delightful tune. You know, I marvel at your equipment. You have absolutely beautiful equipment. That's what struck me when you were in here with the Gin-Soaked Angels. You have just a fabulous set of gear there. Have you collected? I know you come from a musical family, and maybe these got handed down to you.
Well, yeah, I've been playing for a while, about 6 or 7 years, something like that now. And I don't know, there's a certain degree of monetary benefit to playing music. So a lot of the stuff that I have, I've bought by myself, but also a large portion of that has just been gifts from my, like, really, really supportive family. They care a lot about my music, and the first violin I ever had was a, and I still use it, was a gift from my dad, and he got it as a gift from my mom. My mom and dad are very musical people, and they've I've been around music my whole life, and they've both just encouraged me to pursue that path a lot.
Well, it's just lovely and working on it, and I really appreciate the notion of you're doing it all yourself and laying that down. There's so much thought and care. It takes on like a handcrafted feel to each tune, and it really comes through. Dakota Wright, I hope you'll keep us posted on your doings, your goings-on. Thank you so much. What a treat. What a delight. It's just been a real, real pleasure to have you today.
Thank you so much.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the third week of late fall. The sun enters Sagittarius on November 22nd, having traveled 3/4 of its way from autumn equinox to winter solstice. 2 hours before midnight, the sky carries the forms of early winter. The Pleiades, Taurus, and Orion are rising. The Milky Way cuts across the sky from east to west. Andromeda lies directly overhead, and the summer triangle is setting. The final rites of fall include a chronology of the last leaves and fruits. Major losses occur on beeches and pears as autumn ends. Sometimes oaks are the holdouts, sometimes forsythia or a hardy honeysuckle. Sometimes sweet gums and poplars keep a few leaves this late in the year. Sometimes protected oak leaf hydrangeas and osage and mock orange or lilacs outlast all the other trees and shrubs. Bittersweet continues to fall to the undergrowth. Yellow witch hazel flowers are shriveling. Privets are bare and their blue berries revealed. Winterberry fruits are losing their white outer shells and the orange cores are unveiled by the cold. New England aster and stonecrop foliage turned yellow in early November and now the plants are shedding. Late garden lettuce and the autumn growth of rhubarb have withered. Hosta leaves have collapsed into the remnants of maples and ginkgos and white mulberries. The gooseneck loosestrife turns chocolate brown. Most all the seeds are gone from the milkweed pods and just a few wisps of down cling to their shells. Fragile pokeweed stems have exploded in the frost. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the fourth week of late fall. In the meantime, make your last rites, your last farewell for autumn.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at wyso.org.
That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for listening. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.
Nikki Dakota here, inviting you to Thanksgiving Eve with WYSO. Courtesy of some of the finest musicians in the Miami Valley, enjoy a live musical celebration of the band's The Last Waltz with full band and full horn section. Proceeds benefit WYSO. It's going to be such a night. Wednesday, November 27th at 7 at the Dayton Art Institute. Tickets are $15 in advance, 20-day of show. We expect a full house, so claim your tickets now. Details at WYSO.org. Come downtown.
This week on American Roots, the funk soul universe from New Orleans to New York, including all things funky with Stanton Moore and Ben Elman from the band Galactic. Then East Harlem's king of Latin soul, Joe Batan. Plus music from Stevie Wonder, Dr. John, and Joe Cuba. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
Coming up this afternoon at 2 on your public radio station, 91.3 WYSO.